and the public. And if he doesn't do it, and he's very unlikely to do it, then his secretary or his aides or assistant secretaries should risk, sacrifice their careers to avert these wars, which must not happen.
That's Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. His latest book is The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Henry Kissinger once called him the most dangerous man in America. That does it for our show. If you'd like to sign up for our daily digest, our news headlines and news alerts each day, you can text the word Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. Special thanks to our crew here at UC Santa Cruz Learning Technologies, John Radicke, Gary Gyorkos, Juan Perez, Chris Salerno, David Valadez. Also, former Democracy Now! Fellow, now UC Santa Cruz PhD student, Juan Carlos Davila, Dennis Moynihan, and Mike Burke. Special thanks to David Shaw and Gene Fox as well. Happy birthday, Samin Fakande. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Libby Rainey, and Nat Needham. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, Julie Crosby, and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01 and 51 seconds. And coming up next is your Friday evening news. But first, how about this?
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meetings has been rescheduled to take place on Monday, May 21st at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pueblo Unido PDX one-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Join Portlanders in celebrating the recent success and helping community members win their cases against deportation and get out of immigration detentions. This event will feature a reception with the silent auction, raffle, light refreshments, and more. Again, that's the Pueblo Unido PDX one-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You know what's awesome on KBOO between 5 to 5:30 on Fridays? The KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a shooting at a high school in Texas has left 10 dead.
Gresham police shot and killed a man who they say threatened them with a weapon this morning.
And the mystery of the identity of plane hijacker D.B. Cooper may be solved.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 18th, 2018. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. News traveled first through social media platforms. 10 people were killed and 10 others critically wounded in a shooting this morning at a high school in the town of Santa Fe outside Houston, Texas. Texas Governor Greg Abbott confirmed the news. Authorities have said that 2 people are currently detained in connection to the shooting at Santa Fe High School. 17-year-old Demetrios Pagortis has been identified by the Galveston County Sheriff's Office as the shooter. The Sheriff's Office said Pagortis is in jail and accused of capital murder. He allegedly used a shotgun and a .38 revolver to commit the shootings. Police also found a number of explosive devices at the school. Governor Abbott confirmed both guns were legally owned by Pogortsis's father to reporters. Abbott went on to say that two school resource officers were on campus and had confronted the shooter, quote, early on in the process, end quote. Two law enforcement officers were injured in the shooting. President Donald Trump has ordered flags to be flown at half-staff at all federal buildings. According to CNN and a special report on school shootings, there has been, on average, one school shooting every week this year. We are 20 weeks into the 2018 school year, and there have been 22 school shootings to date that have claimed lives or wounded individuals.
The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office yesterday released the name of the deputy who shot 36-year-old Vasil Manta on Monday. Matt Ferguson is a 12-year member of the Sheriff's Office. He was a parole officer with Multnomah County Adult Community Justice for 6 years prior to that. Ferguson currently serves as the president of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Deputy Association, the union that represents county line officers. Last June, he wrote an open letter to public officials following major protests in Portland in the wake of two murders by a white supremacist person on a MAX train. Multnomah County riot police in hard gear were a prominent feature of the June 4th event when thousands of counter-protesters showed up to drown out a far-right rally in Shrunk Plaza. Ferguson's letter complained of a public atmosphere that had made policing careers, quote, undervalued and dehumanizing, end quote, and expressed doubt in the existence of factual evidence for systemic racism. Ferguson will be on paid administrative leave until the completion of the investigation and grand jury. It has not been announced whether or not he will be serving as union president while on leave.
Vasil Manta had been shot at by a still unidentified Gresham police officer on April 30th. That incident reportedly began when the Gresham officer responded to the report of a stolen minivan which was being driven by Manta. Manta reportedly rammed the minivan into the police car before fleeing on foot around Powell Boulevard, whereupon the officer fired. It's still unclear if the officer missed or injured Manta. Gresham police were searching for the wrong suspect at first and then announced that Manta was their person of interest 2 days before Deputy Matt Ferguson spotted him in a Burger King parking lot in East Portland on Monday. Deputy Ferguson was in the area as part of the Sheriff's Office Special Investigations Unit, which was actively looking for Manta, and it is still unclear how many other deputies were present at the time. When he was approached, Manta reportedly backed up and rammed into an unmarked Multnomah County Sheriff's Office vehicle, at which point Ferguson opened fire. The Sheriff's Office has not been clear about how many shots were fired or Manta's exact condition, though they did say that he was provided immediate medical attention and transported to a local hospital where he remains in critical condition as of this past Monday. He's not been booked into the Multnomah County Detention Center yet, though he was charged with aggravated attempted murder and identity theft.
Gresham police were involved in another police shooting this morning. It is the second officer-involved shooting by Gresham police in less than 3 weeks. Two officers fatally shot a man who they referred to as, quote, threatening with a weapon. They say they were dispatched to a report of a suspicious vehicle in Southwest Gresham, and that after locating the vehicle, the suspect, identified only as male, immediately fled. There is no information released as to the circumstances in which they found the vehicle and the driver, nor how the officers approached the vehicle, nor how they made their presence known. They did not pursue the fleeing man, but found the vehicle crashed on Southwest Pleasant View Drive, north of Southwest Highland Drive, in a residential neighborhood. When officers contacted the driver, he reportedly threatened them with a weapon, and two officers opened fire. The man was pronounced dead at the scene. The East County Major Crimes Team is investigating. The constituent agencies were not announced, but these investigations usually include detectives with both the Sheriff's Office and the Portland Police Bureau. According to data from Portland Cop Watch, Oregon law enforcement averaged 24 police shootings each year between 2010 and 2017. In 2018, there have been 17 in less than 5 months.
And now it's National Native News, a daily newscast about Native issues and culture from Native Voice One.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The head of Canada's largest Native organization says the federal government should delay legalizing marijuana for at least a year. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the government plans to make marijuana legal by the end of the summer.
Perry Bellegarde is the national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. His comments about the delay came after the Senate Aboriginal Peoples Committee released a report after it studied what impacts pot legalization would have on Native communities. The committee says those communities need more time. And Bellegarde agrees, adding that it would give Native groups time to consult with their people because Native groups were not originally consulted about the legislation.
We've always talked about duty, consult, and accommodate. So there's issues of education, about health, about the excise tax. Again, that we weren't part of those dialogues and discussions. So if that's what the Senate committee or the report's recommending, we'd concur with that because it does affect our people as well.
The Senate committee described the issue as an alarming lack of consultation with Indigenous communities. The report adds that time is needed to also develop culturally appropriate educational materials to make sure Native people understand the new law. And there must also be addiction and mental health support available and discussions about tax sharing. Some reserves also want the ability to enact their own bylaws on the sale and use of marijuana, such as they already do in barring alcohol sales. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The University of South Dakota Center for Disabilities is launching an educational outreach effort focused on Native Americans. The Oyate Circle will host workshops in tribal communities, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jackie Hendry reports.
Jim Warren is a member of the Oglala Lakota Tribe and has more than 20 years of experience running disability-focused training groups in San Diego, California. He's been hired to lead the new program and says he's excited to help his own tribe and others in the state. Warren says the workshops will include input from disability counselors, tribal vocational rehabilitation groups, and staff from both USD and tribal colleges.
I want to have kind of a buffet of services and awareness in terms of where folks can come in and just be aware of the variety of services available.
He says each workshop will produce a handbook of materials for participants that he calls Disabilities 101. Warren says rates of disabilities are disproportionately high for Native Americans, but treatment can be difficult to find.
And a lot of that has to do with the poverty realities of many of our reservations, as well as the health care. The Indian Health Service does what it can, but it's underfunded, so therefore doesn't have the access to a lot of the disability specialized services and supports in the medical field.
In addition to partnerships with tribal colleges, Warren says the Oyate Circle will also give diversity presentations to the State Department of Health and Human Services. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Hendry in South Dakota.
The Oyate Circle's first workshop is May 25th at Oglala Lakota College, with more scheduled around the state in July. The House Appropriations Committee Thursday adopted an amendment to support tribal victim service programs. It was adopted by a voice vote. The McCollum-Cole Amendment modifies the Commerce, Justice, Science Appropriations Bill. Without it, tribal funding would be cut from the Crime Victims Fund. Tribes and Native organizations hope similar language will be included in the Senate version of the bill, which is expected to be marked up in June. The four-day Navajo Hopi Honor Ride began Thursday in St. Michael's, Arizona. Motorcyclists started the event in 2003 to honor Lori Paestiwa, the first female Native American to be killed in combat. This year, participants will cover 1,000 miles in Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado to honor veterans and those who lost their lives in military conflicts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
One of the Pacific Northwest's most enduring mysteries may or may not be solved. No, Bigfoot is still out there, maybe even standing behind you right now. But the identity of D.B. Cooper, the smooth skyjacker who disappeared after parachuting out of an airplane over the Columbia River in 1971 with $200,000 in cash, may be that of a Michigan man who died in 2014. A majority of investigators and experts believe it is likely that Cooper did not survive his high-risk jump. But yesterday, at a book release in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a writer claimed that his best friend, Walter Recca, confessed to being D.B. Cooper before his death. Carl Lauren was joined by Recca's niece, Lisa Story, who also claimed that Recca confessed to her. Lauren, who is a member of the Michigan Parachute Club with RECA, described his friend as, quote, a daredevil. As evidence, Lauren offers records of how RECA spent the $200,000 and audio recordings of phone messages in which RECA supposedly relates details of the hijacking before they were made public. The FBI closed their investigation of the hijacking in 2016, 45 years after it occurred. In a statement yesterday, they called Lauren's evidence plausible, but not strong enough to prove RECA's culpability beyond a reasonable doubt. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, a production of the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses with Della Ray and Lady Monty. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will see a low of 54 degrees with a 10% chance of rain and light winds. Tomorrow will be slightly warmer than today with a high of 73 and scattered clouds. Today in history, in 1652, Rhode Island passed the first law in English North America outlawing slavery. Progressing forward to 1896, this day also saw the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Plessy v. Ferguson, which found the doctrine of separate but equal constitutional, essentially enshrining racial segregation in private facilities into law. It was not overturned until the Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, decision in 1954. The quote of the day is from American socialist, LGBTQ advocate, civil rights activist, pacifist, and singer Bayard Rustin, who said, quote, "When an individual is protesting society's refusal to acknowledge his dignity as a human being, his very act of protest confers dignity on him," end quote.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News on Friday, May 18th, 2018.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is May 19th, and on this day, in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson chose Patricia Harris to become the U.S. ambassador to Luxembourg. Patricia Harris was the first African-American woman named as an American envoy. In 1961, Harris worked briefly for the U.S. Department of Justice before returning to Howard University as an associate dean of law at Howard's Law School.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
You are listening to the...
Many in the media viewed Rex Tillerson's commencement address to the graduating class at VMI as an indirect criticism of President Trump. KBOO's Ray Bodwell thinks that they may have missed the point.
Former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson gave the commencement address at the Virginia Military Institute on Wednesday, and although he never mentioned Donald Trump by name, many in the media interpreted his comments as a public rebuke of his former boss. Comments like this appeared to buttress their case.
As I reflect upon the state of our American democracy, I observe a growing crisis in ethics and integrity. If our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or we as people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on a pathway to relinquishing our freedom.
I didn't personally get the sense that this speech was just a thinly veiled shot at Trump. First, let's not forget, it was a commencement speech. And if you listen to the whole 20 minutes, it was actually a very well-crafted one. He alluded to time and experiences at both ExxonMobil and the State Department and urged the graduates to take a worldview.
Seeing the future in a global context requires recognizing the rapid economic development taking place the world over and the challenges that will come from meeting the needs and realizing the aspirations of billions of people on this planet. We must acknowledge, however, that every nation has a right to aspire to a better quality of life. This is the world you enter. It is a world in dramatic transition and change.
He then shifted to a discussion of ethics and integrity.
As to the matter of integrity, I am familiar with VMI's honor code. It was one of the reasons I look so much forward to addressing you today. But a warning to you as you leave this place, a place where the person sitting on either side of you shares that same understanding. You will now enter a world where, sadly, that is not always the case. And your commitment to this high standard of ethical behavior and integrity will be tested.
The VMI honor code that he mentioned states that a cadet will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those who do. And his comment that their commitment to integrity will be tested is no doubt based on his vast personal experience. But as I listened to Tillerson's speech, I found myself thinking about his tenure as CEO of ExxonMobil and questioning whether he was the right person to be delivering a lecture on the importance of ethics and integrity. And wasn't it clear from his first day on the job as Secretary of State that ethics and integrity were not concepts or talking points that would resonate much in the Trump White House? But I think Tillerson realized that that's besides the point. He was speaking to a graduating college class. The graduates are well aware of his history and the corporate and political power structure. They know he knows what he's talking about when he references the need to take a global view and to recognize the needs and aspirations of the entire world's population. They know that he was lamenting the fact that the U.S. has become a self-involved pariah in the eyes of the world. And hopefully they realize that he was begging them to reclaim some of the moral high ground that the current generation of leaders, public and private, has abandoned. At least that's the way it came across to me. Maybe Tillerson wasn't the best guy to deliver that message, but it was absolutely the right message. And I hope it's being repeated in some form or another at graduating ceremonies around the country, because we're counting on the next generation to undo the damage that we've done. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
A Black Panther Party member who has spent more time behind bars than any other prisoner had his parole hearing canceled earlier this month. Ann Garrison with KPFA Berkeley has this report.
On May 4th, Romaine Chip Fitzgerald's parole hearing was postponed for another 5 years. Fitzgerald has served more time than any former Black Panther still behind bars. He was convicted of murdering a security guard and attempting to murder a highway patrolman in a shootout after he and fellow Panthers were stopped for a traffic violation in 1969, at the height of the FBI's COINTEL program to destroy the Panthers. I spoke to Fitzgerald's lawyer, Charles Carbone. Charles Carbone, could you tell us what happened at Romaine Chip Fitzgerald's parole hearing? Did the hearing even take place?
The hearing did not take place. We stipulated to a five-year parole denial. In fact, we sought a lesser period of parole denial, which under the law is 3 years. But unfortunately, the parole board refused the three-year stipulated denial, which left us in the unenviable position of having to stipulate to a five-year parole denial. The reason why we did not want to go forward with the hearing altogether is some recent disciplinary problems that Chip has had. Under the law, the crime, the life crimes for which he's been convicted of, those have lost largely their value, their predictive value for whether or not he would succeed in society. The parole board doesn't really invest in those very old crimes anymore. And the law is fairly clear that they shouldn't invest in those old crimes. He's been in prison for almost 50 years now. So those crimes are not indicative of how he would behave, even if you assume the worst of those crimes, even if you buy completely into the DA's, the district attorney's theory of those crimes and the state's theory of those crimes. even with that negative light around them, the crimes don't have any value. What does have value, however, is his behavior in prison. And it's sort of a catch-22, because if somebody is in prison for reasons that are questionable, and then they end up misbehaving in that environment, unfortunately, the catch-22 is such that the parole board will severely penalize the person for any misconduct in prison. And that is basically what has happened here, such that the most recent psychological evaluation done by a forensic psychologist who is hired by the parole board, that person determined that Chip was a high risk for recidivism should he be released. So the combination of some recent misconduct in prison and this forensic psychologist hired by the board thinking that that misconduct was indicative of Chip potentially recidivating on parole, the combination of those two things would have been a dire outcome at any substantive parole hearing. We would have gotten slammed with a very long denial. And so in order to avoid that denial, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of good options, but the best one that we had was to put the hearing off, which is essentially what we did. That will give Chip a greater opportunity to prove that any disciplinaries are basically anomalies, that they're not in conformity with his character and who he is as a person, and that he is very serious about obeying rules and regulations, which, you know, better or worse, is a requirement of parole. And we just need that time in order to establish that record. The good news is that we don't have to wait the full 5 years. If we so desire and we think that we have cured or fixed some of the problems that the board identified and Chip successfully programs, as the term is known, basically walks a straight line in prison. If that happens, then we can go back in a shorter period of time, perhaps a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years, and at such time say to the parole board, hey, board, cured some of the problems here. Can you hear us earlier? And they have, at their discretion, albeit at their discretion, they have the power to bring him back at an earlier date.
Well, what sort of violations or what sort of prison rule infractions is he accused of?
Not even an accusation. It's actually guilty findings. And he has some for possession of cell phones. And in fact, he has a few, one in February of 2018, one in 2017. And then you couple that with some difficulties that he was having back in 2009 as well. But the crux of it is the proliferation of cell phones inside prison is such that they're very tempting for inmates to pick up, especially because prison is such an isolating experience. It, you know, incapacitates you to the extent that you really can't talk to your loved ones or your family. And so Chip, you know, he wants to be a grandfather. He wants to be connected to his family. He wants to be connected to his friends. And he just made some bad choices, for lack of a better term, in terms of picking up those cell phones and utilizing them. And although, you know, I challenge almost anybody in his position to be able to deal with the isolation, it's an Herculean burden. And he just picked up a cell phone, used it a couple times, and the parole board doesn't think it's innocuous. They look at that stuff as very serious, because to them, it's a threat to the safety and security of the prison. And there's also instances, unlike Chip's, where people who are more nefarious use those cell phones to commit further crimes. So they're not alleging that he did that, but they are alleging, and in fact, they found him guilty of personal use of a cell phone.
Okay. I have a copy of the memorandum accusing Chip of various gang affiliations between 2010 and 2012, and it says, quote, confidential information was received alleging you were influential and or in a leadership position amongst the black inmate population. That's an overtly racist statement, inferring that the whole black inmate population is a gang. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, the Department of Corrections is playing fast and loose with the facts, because they have discrete security threat groups. There are discrete criminal enterprises in prison that are of all races. And if they have actionable facts that they think Chip has influence in those real criminal enterprises, then they can put a case together. But they haven't. All they've done is they use speculation, innuendo, and hunch and all these things and a lot of confidential informants to offer these weird blanket insinuations, not even talking about a particular security threat group or prison gang or street gang, but talking about black inmates. That's an absurdity. That type of charge, it holds no water or weight in my mind, in the eyes of the